floor and onto the back seat once more. I felt Prabhakar's hands on me.
Nothing broken, you are, Lin. You are okay.
I'm okay.
You are sure? Everything not broken?
Jesus, Prabhu, I don't care how good this guy's spitting is, I said, laughing nervously and ragged with relief. He doesn't get a tip. Are you all right?
They must get out, Lin, he answered,
his voice rising to a hysterical whine.
Out! Out of here! Now!
The door on his side was jammed shut, and he began to push at it with his shoulder. He couldn't budge it. He reached across me to try the door on my side, but saw at once that another car was jammed against it, pinning it shut. Our eyes met, and there was such fear in him, such terror in the white-rimmed bulge of his eyes, that I felt the coldness of it deep in my chest. He turned at once and threw himself again at the door on his side. My mind was muddy water, and one idea splashed up from it, clear and exclusive. Fire. Is that what he's afraid of? Once I'd asked myself the question, I couldn't stop thinking it. I looked at the terror that pulled at Prabhakar's gasping mouth, and I was sure the taxi was going to catch fire. I knew we were trapped there. The rear windows in all the Bombay taxis I'd seen didn't open beyond a few centimetres. The doors were jammed, and the windows wouldn't open, and the taxi was going to explode in fire, and we were trapped. Burned alive. Is that why he's so scared? I looked to the driver. He was slumped awkwardly between the steering wheel and the door. His body was still, but I heard him moaning. Beneath the thin shirt, the abacus ridge of his spine rose and fell with each slow and shallow breath. Faces appeared at the windows of the cab, and I heard excited voices. Prabhakar looked out at them, turning this way and that, his face cramped in an expression of terrible anguish. Suddenly, he clambered over the seat into the front of the car and wrestled the passenger door open. Turning swiftly and grabbing at my arms with surprising strength, he tried to drag me by main force over the seat that divided us.
This way, Lin! Get out now! Hurry! Hurry!
I climbed up and over the seat. Prabhakar got out of the car, pushing his way into a crowd of onlookers. I reached out to the driver, trying to prise him from the obstructing rim of the steering wheel. But Prabhakar's hands were on me again, brutally rough. The fingernails of one hand tore into the skin of my back, and the other wrenched at the collar of my shirt.
Don't touch him, Lin! He almost screamed. Don't touch him! Leave him and get out! Get out now!
He dragged me from the car and through the hedge of bodies pressing in on the accident. On a footpath nearby, we sat beneath a fringe of hawthorn leaves that overhung a fence of wrought iron spears and inspected one another for injuries. The cut on my forehead, above my right eye, wasn't as serious as I'd thought. The bleeding had already stopped, and it began to weep a clear, plasmic fluid. I was sore in a few places, but it was no cause for concern. Prabhakar cradled his arm, the same arm that had pulled me from the car with such irresistible power, and it was obvious that he was in pain. A large swelling had already formed near the elbow. I knew it would leave a nasty bruise, but nothing seemed to be broken.
Looks like you were wrong, Prabhu, I chided, smiling as I lit a cigarette for him.
Wrong, Baba.
Getting us out of the car in such a panic and all. You really had me going. I thought the damn thing was going to catch fire, but it looks okay.
Oh, he replied softly, staring straight ahead. You think I was frightened for fire? Not fire in the car, Lin, but fire in the people. Look now. See the public, how they are.
We stood, stretching the ache from shoulders and whiplashed necks, and looked toward the wreckage some 10 meters away. About 30 people had gathered around the 4 crashed vehicles. A few of them were helping drivers and passengers from the damaged cars. The rest huddled together in groups, gesturing wildly and shouting. More people streamed towards the site from every direction. Drivers of other cars that had been blocked from travelling further left their vehicles and joined the crowd. The 30 people became 50, 80, then 100 as we watched. One man was the centre of attention. It was his car that had been trying to turn right, his car we'd smashed into with the brakes on full lock. He stood beside the taxi, bellowing with rage.
He was a round-shouldered man, in his middle 40s, wearing a grey cotton safari suit that had been tailored to accommodate the extravagant boast of his large paunch. His thinning hair was awry. The breast pocket of his suit had been torn. There was a rip in his trousers, and he'd lost one sandal. That dishevelment combined with his theatrical gestures and persistent shouting to present a spectacle that seemed to be more enthralling for the crowd of onlookers than the wreckage of the cars. His hand had been cut from the palm to the wrist. As the staring crowd grew more silent, subdued by the drama, he smeared blood from the wound on his face and beat the redness into the grey of his suit, shouting all the while. Just then, some men carried a woman into the little clear space around the man and placed her on a piece of cloth that was stretched out on the ground for her. They shouted instructions to the crowd, and in moments a wooden cart appeared, pushed by bare-chested men wearing only singlets and short lungis. The woman was lifted onto the cart, her red sari gathered up in folds and wrapped about her legs. She may have been the man's wife, I couldn't be sure, but his rage suddenly grew hysterical. He seized her roughly by the shoulders and shook her. He pulled at her hair. He appealed to the crowd with enormous, histrionic gestures, flinging his arms wide and then striking his own blood-streaked face. They were the gestures of pantomime, the exaggerated simulations of silent films, and I couldn't help thinking they were absurd and funny. But the injuries people had sustained were real, as were the rumbling threats that surged through the ever-increasing crowd. As the semi-conscious woman was trundled away on the humble cart, the man hurled himself at the door of the taxi, wrenching it open. The crowd reacted as one. They dragged the dazed and injured taxi driver from his cab in an instant and flung him on the bonnet of the car. He raised his arms in feeble pleading, but a dozen, 20, 50 hands punched and tore at him. Blows drummed on his face, chest, stomach, and groin. Fingernails scratched and ripped, tearing his mouth open on one side almost to the ear and shredding his shirt to rags. It happened in seconds. I told myself, as I watched the beating, that it was all too fast, that I was dazed, that there was no time to react. What we call cowardice is often just another name for being taken by surprise, and courage is seldom any better than simply being well prepared. And I might have done more. I might have done something, anything, if it had happened in Australia. It's not your country, I told myself, as I watched the beating. It's not your culture. But there was another thought, dark and secret then, and all too clear to me now. The man was an idiot, an insulting and belligerent idiot, whose reckless stupidity had risked Prabhakar's life and mine. A splinter of spite had pierced my heart when the crowd turned on him. And at least some small particle of their revenge, a blow or a shout or a shove, was my own. Helpless, craven, ashamed, I did nothing. "We've got to do something," I said lamely.
"Enough people are doing, Baba," Prabhakar replied.
"No, I mean, we've got to... Can't we help him somehow?"
"For this fellow is no helping," he sighed. "Now you see it, Lin. Accidents is very bad business in Bombay. Better you get out of that car or taxi or what is it you are in very, very quickly. The public are not having patience for such business. See now, it is too late for that fellow."
The beating was swift but savage. Blood streamed from many cuts on the man's face and naked torso. At a signal, perceived somehow through the howl and shriek of the crowd, the man was lifted up and carried off at head height. His legs were pressed together and stretched out, held rigid by a dozen hands. His arms were splayed out at right angles to his body and held fast. His head lolled and fell back, the soft wet flap of skin hanging from cheek to jaw. His eyes were open, conscious, staring backward and upside down. Black eyes scudded with fear and imbecile hope. Traffic on the far side of the road parted to let the people pass, and the man slowly disappeared, crucified on the hands and shoulders of the crowd.
"Come on, Lin. Let's go. You okay?"
"I'm all right," I mumbled, forcing myself to shuffle into step beside him. My self-assurance had melted through muscle and bone to settle in my knees. Each step was leaden and willed. It wasn't the violence that had shaken me. I'd seen worse and with far less provocation in prison. It was instead the too sudden collapse of my stilted complacencies. The weeks of the city I'd thought I was beginning to know. The Bombay of temples, bazaars, restaurants, and new friends had cindered in the fires of that public rage.
What are they going to do with him?
They will take him to police, I think so. Behind Crawford Market is one police station for this area. Maybe he will have the luck. Maybe alive he will reach there. Maybe not. He has a very quickly karma, this fellow.
You've seen this before?
Oh, many times, Lin Baba. Sometimes I drive it my cousin Shantu's taxi. I have seen so many angry publics. That is why I was getting so afraid for you, and for my good self also.
Why does it happen like that? Why do they get so crazy about it?
That is nobody knows, Lin,
Prabhakar shrugged, quickening his pace a little. Wait a minute, I paused, slowing him with a hand to his shoulder. Where are we going?
Still going for the tour, isn't it?
I thought maybe you want to call it off for today.
Calling off? Why? We have it a real and full deal to seal in, Baba. So let's go, nah?
But what about your arm? Don't you want to get it seen too?
No problem, this arm's Lin. For last of the touring, we will have some whiskey drinks in a terrible place I know. That will be a good medicine. So come on, let's go now, Baba.
Well, okay, if you say so. But we were going the other way, weren't we?
Still going the other way, Baba, Prabhakar replied with some urgency. But first going this way only. Over there is a telephone at the station. I must call my cousin, working now at Sunshine Restaurant as the dishes washing boy. He is wanting a taxi driving job for his brother, Suresh. And I must give it the number and boss name of the driver now gone with the people. That fellow's boss will be needing a new driver now, and we must hurry for such a good chance, isn't it?
Prabhakar made that call. Seconds later, he continued his tour of the dark side of the city without a heartbeat of hesitation, in another taxi, as if nothing had happened. Nor did he ever raise the matter with me again. When I occasionally spoke of it, he responded with a shrug or some bland comment about our good luck in avoiding serious injury. For him, the incident was like a brawl in a nightclub or a clash of rival supporters at a football match. Commonplace and unremarkable, unless you happen to be in the centre of it. But for me, that sudden, savage, bewildering riot, the sight of that taxi driver floating away on a rippling wave of hands, shoulders and heads, was a turning point. A new understanding emerged from it. I suddenly realised that if I wanted to stay there, in Bombay, the city I'd already fallen in love with, I had to change. I had to get involved. The city wouldn't let me be a watcher, aloof and apart. If I wanted to stay, I had to expect that she would drag me into the river of her rapture and her rage. Sooner or later, I knew, I would have to step off the pavement and into the bloody crowd and put my body on the line. And with the seed of that resolve, born in that convulsion and portent, Prabhakar's dark circuit of the city began. When we resumed our tour, he took me to a slave market not far from Dongri, an inner suburb famous for its mosques, bazaars and restaurants specialising in Mughlai dishes. The main road became streets, and the streets became lanes, and when those proved too narrow for the taxi to negotiate, we left the vehicle and walked together in the sinuous busyness of the crowds. The further we travelled into the Catiline lanes, the more we lost of the day, the year, the very age in which we lived. As automobiles and then scooters disappeared, the air became clearer, sharper, with the scents of spices and perfumes undulled by the diesel and petrol fumes prevalent elsewhere. Traffic noise faded, ceased, and was replaced by street sound, a class of children reciting verses from the Quran in a little courtyard, the whir and scrape of stone on stone as women ground spices in doorways, and the whining optimism of cries from knife sharpeners, mattress fluffers, stove repairers, and other hawkers. They were people sounds, everywhere, played with voice and hand. At one turn in the puzzle alleyways, we passed a long metal rack where bicycles were parked. From then on, even those simple machines vanished. Goods were transported by bearers with enormous bundles on their heads. One burden usually carried by all, the thudding pressure of the Bombay sun, was lifted from us. The lanes were dark, cool, shadowless. Although only 3 and at most 4 stories tall, the buildings leaned in upon the winding pathways, and the sky was reduced to a thin brushstroke of pale blue. The buildings themselves were ancient and dilapidated. Stone facades, which had once been splendid and impressive, were crumbling, grimed, and patched with haphazard necessity. Here and there, small balconies jutted out to meet one another overhead, so close that neighbours could reach across and pass things with an outstretched hand. Glimpses inside the houses showed unpainted walls and sagging staircases. Many ground floor windows were held open to reveal makeshift shops for the sale of sweets, cigarettes, groceries, vegetables, and utensils. It was clear that the plumbing was rudimentary, where it was connected at all. We passed several places where women gathered with metal or clay pots to collect water from a single outside tap. And skeined over all the buildings, like metal cobwebs, were complicated traceries of electrical conduits and wires, as if even that symbol and source of the modern age and its power was no more than a fragile, temporary net that might be swept away by a rough gesture. Just as the contracted lanes seemed with every twist and turn to belong to another age, so too did the appearance of the people change as we moved deeper into the maze. I saw less and less of the Western-style cotton shirts and trousers so common everywhere else in the city, until finally those fashions disappeared from all but the youngest children. Instead, the men wore traditional garments of colourful diversity. There were long silk shirts that descended to the knee and were fastened with pearl buttons from neck to waist, caftan robes in plain colours or stripes, hooded cloaks that resembled the garb of monks, and an endless variety of skull caps in white or beaded colours, and turbans in yellow, red, and electric blue. The women were more conspicuously bejewelled, despite the indigence of the quarter, and what those jewels lacked in money's worth was found in the extravagance of their design. No less prominent were caste-mark tattoos on some foreheads, cheeks, hands and wrists, and every bare feminine foot was graced by anklets of silver bells and coiled brass toe rings. It was as if all of those hundreds of people were costumed for home, for themselves, not for the public promenades. It was as if they were safe there, to clothe themselves in tradition and display. And the streets were clean. The buildings were cracked and smeared. The constricted passageways were crowded with goats, chickens, dogs, and people. And each thin face showed the shade and hollows of penury. But the streets and the people were stainlessly, scrupulously clean. We turned then into more ancient alleyways, so narrow that two persons passed one another only with difficulty. People stepped into doorways, waiting for us to walk past before they moved on. The passages had been covered with false ceilings and stretched awnings, and in the darkness it wasn't possible to see more than a few metres in front or behind. I kept my eyes on Prabhakar, fearful that I wouldn't find my way out alone. The little guide turned often, drawing my attention to a loose stone in the path ahead, or a step, or some obstruction overhead. Concentrating on those perils, I lost my orientation. My mental map of the city turned, blurred, faded, and I couldn't guess at the direction of the sea or the major landmarks, Flora Fountain, VT Station, Crawford Market, we'd passed on our way to the quarter. I felt myself to be so deep in the flow and reflux of those narrow lanes, so smothered by the intimacy of open doors and perfumed bodies, that it seemed I was walking inside the buildings, inside the very homes, rather than between them. We came upon a stall where a man in a sweat-stained cotton vest stirred battered foods, frying in a dish of bubbling oil. The blue flames of his kerosene stove, eerie and claustral, provided the only light. Emotion haunted his face. It was anguish, some kind of anguish, and the dull, stoic anger that hangs in the eyes of repetitive, ill-paid work. Prabhakar moved past him and into the darkness beyond. As I approached the man, he turned to face me, and his eyes met mine. For a moment, the full force of his blue-lit anger was directed at me. Long years after that day, the Afghan guerrillas I came to know as friends, on a mountain near the siege of Kandahar, talked for hours about Indian films and their favourite Bollywood movie stars. "Indian actors are the greatest in the world," one of them said once, "because Indian people know how to shout with their eyes." That backstreet fried foods cook stared at me with shouting eyes and stopped me as surely as if he'd pushed a hand into my chest. I couldn't move. In my own eyes, there were words. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you have to do this work. I'm sorry that your world, your life, is so hot and dark and unremembered. I'm sorry that I'm intruding." Still staring at me, he grasped the handles of his dish. For one, two thudding heartbeats, I was gripped by the ridiculous, terrifying thought that he was going to throw the boiling oil in my face. Fear jerked at my feet, and I moved, easing my way past him with my hands flat against the damp surface of the stone wall. Two steps beyond him, my foot struck a crack in the path, and I stumbled and fell, dragging another man down with me. He was an elderly man, thin and frail. I could feel the wicker basket of his bones through his coarse tunic. We fell heavily, landing near the open entrance to a house, and the old man struck his head. I scrambled to my feet, slipping and sliding on a pile of shifting stones. I tried to help the man to stand, but there was an elderly woman who squatted on her haunches there, in the open doorway, and she slapped at my hands, warning me away. I apologized in English, struggling to find the words for "I'm sorry" in Hindi. "What are they? Prabhakar taught me the words. Mujhaiko afsos hai. That's it." I said it 3-4 times. In that dark, quiet corridor between the buildings, the words echoed like a drunkard's prayer in an empty church. The old man moaned quietly, slouching in the doorway. The woman wiped his face with a corner of her headscarf and held the cloth out for me to see the bright stain of blood. She said nothing, but her wrinkled face was creased with a frown of contempt. With that simple gesture, holding out the blood-stained cloth, she seemed to be saying, "Look, you stupid oaf, you great clumsy barbarian, look what you've done here." I felt choked by the heat, smothered by the darkness and the strangeness of the place. The walls seemed to press upon my hands, as if only my arms prevented them from closing in on me altogether. I backed away from the elderly couple, stumbling at first, and then plunging headlong into the shadowland of the tunnel street. A hand reached out to grab at my shoulder. It was a gentle touch, but I almost shouted out loud.
"This way, Baba," Prabhakar said, laughing quietly. "Where are you taking yourself? This way only. Along this passage now, and you must be keeping your 2 feet to the outside, because too much dirty it is in the middle of the passages, okay?"
He was standing in the entrance to a narrow gap formed between the blank walls of 2 buildings. Feeble light gleamed in the teeth and eyes of his smile, but beyond him was only blackness. He turned his back to me, spread his feet out until they touched the walls, braced himself with his hands, and then shuffled off, sliding his feet along the walls in small, dragging steps. He expected me to follow. I hesitated, but when the awkward star of his shuffling form melted in the darkness and vanished, I too put my feet out against the walls and shambled after him. I could hear Prabhakar ahead of me, but it was so dark that I couldn't see him. One foot strayed from the edge of the wall, and my boot squelched into a muddy slime that rested in the centre of the path. A foul smell rose up from that viscous ooze, and I kept my feet hard against the walls, sliding them along in short steps. Something squat and heavy slithered past me, rasping its thick body against my boot. Seconds later, another and then a third creature waddled past me in the darkness, rolling heavy flesh over the toes of my boots.
"Prabhu!" I bellowed, not knowing how far ahead of me he was. "There are things in here with us!" "Dings, Baba!" "On the ground! Something's crawling on my feet! Something heavy!"
"Only rats are crawling here, Lin. There are no dings."
"Rats? Are you kidding? These things are as big as bull terriers. Jesus, this is some tour, my friend."
"No problem, big rats, Lin,"
Prabhakar answered quietly from the darkness in front of me.
"Big rats are friendly fellows, not making mischief for the people. If you don't attack them, only one thing is making them bite and scratch and such things."
"What's that, for God's sake?"
"Shouting, Baba," he replied softly. "They don't like the loud voices."
"Oh, great, now you tell me," I croaked. "Is that much further? This is starting to give me the creeps and..."
He'd stopped, and I bumped into him, pressing him against the panelled surface of a wooden door.
"Yeah, here,"
he whispered, reaching out to knock with a complex series of taps and pauses. There was a scrape and clunk as a heavy bolt slid free, and then the door swung open, dazzling us with sudden bright light. Prabhakar grasped my sleeve and dragged me with him.
"Quickly, Lin, no big rats allowed inside."
We stepped inside a small chamber, hemmed in by blank walls and lit from high above by a raw silk rectangle of sky. I could hear voices from deeper within the cul-de-sac. A huge man slammed the gate shut. He put his back to it and faced us with a scowl, teeth bared. Prabhakar began to talk at once, placating him with soft words and fawning gestures. The man shook his head repeatedly, interjecting regularly to say, "No, no, no." He towered over me. I was standing so close to him that I could feel the breath from his wide nostrils, the sound of it like wind whistling through caves on a rocky shore. His hair was very short, exposing ears as large and knubbled as a boxer's practice mitts. His square face seemed to be animated by more strong muscle tissue than the average man has in his back. His chest, as wide as I was from shoulder to shoulder, rose and fell with each breath and rested upon an immense belly. The fine dagger line of his moustache accentuated his scowl, and he looked at me with such undiluted loathing that a little prayer unfurled itself in my mind. "Please, God, don't make me fight this man." He raised the palms of his hands to stop Prabhakar's wheedling cajolery. They were huge hands, gnarled and calloused enough to scrape the barnacles off the side of a dry-docked oil tanker.
"He says we are not allowed inside," Prabhakar explained.
"Well," I replied, reaching past the man and attempting with unforced enthusiasm to open the door.
"You can't say we didn't try."
"No, no, Lin," Prabhakar stopped me. "We must argue with him about this matter."
The big man folded his arms, stretching the seams of his khaki shirt with little ripples of sound.
"I don't think that's such a good idea," I mumbled under a tight smile.
"Certainly it is," Prabhakar insisted. "Tourists are not allowed here, or to any of the other people markets. But I have told him that you are not one of these tourist fellows. I have told him that you have learned the Marathi language. He does not believe me. That is our problem only. He doesn't believe any foreigner will speak Marathi. You must, for that reason, speak it a little Marathi for him. You will see. He will allow us inside.
I only know about 20 words of Marathi, Prabhu.
No problem, 20 words, Baba. Just make a begin. You will see. Tell him your name.
My name?
Yes, like I taught it to you. Not in Hindi, but in Marathi. Okay, just begin.
Maza nao Lin Ahe, I muttered uncertainly. My name is Lin.
Bapri,
the big man gasped, his eyes wide with genuine surprise.
Good Lord!
Encouraged, I tried a few more of the phrases Prabhaka had taught me during the last few weeks.
Mazadesh New Zealand ahe. Atame Kolaba Rahela ahe.
My country is New Zealand. I am living in Kolaba now.
Kaigaram Machud,
he roared, smiling for the first time. The phrase literally means, what a hot motherfucker. It's so frequently and inventively applied in conversation, however, that it can be loosely translated as son of a gun. The giant grasped my shoulder, squeezing it with amiable severity. I ran through the range of my Marathi phrases, beginning with the first words I'd asked Prabhaka to teach me. I love your country very much. And concluding with a request I was often forced to make in restaurants, but which must have seemed spectacularly inappropriate in the little alcove. Please turn off the fan while I am eating my soup.
Enough now, Baba, Prabhaka gurgled through his wide grin.
When I fell silent, the big man spoke swiftly and exuberantly. Prabhaka translated for him, nodding and gesturing expressively with his hands.
He says he is Bombay policeman, and his name is Vinod.
He's a cop?
Oh, yes, Lin, a police cop he is.
Do the cops run this place?
Oh, no, this is part-time work only. He says he is so very, very happy to meet you. He says you are the first Gora he ever met who can speak Marathi. He says some foreigners speak Hindi, but nobody foreigner can speak Marathi. He says Marathi is his language. His native place is Pune. He says they speak it a very pure Marathi in Pune, and you must go there to hear it. He says he's too happy. You're like a son to him. He says you must come to his house and eat foods and meet his family. He says that will be 100 rupees.
What was that?
Bakshishlin. To go inside. 100 rupees it is. Pay him now.
Oh, sure. I fumbled a few notes from my pocket, peeled off 100 rupees and handed it over. There's a special sleight of hand that's peculiar to policemen. The conjuring trick that palms and conceals banknotes with a skill that experienced shell game swindlers envy. The big man collected the money with a two-handed handshake, smeared a palm across his chest as if brushing away crumbs after eating a sandwich, and then scratched at his nose with practiced innocence. The money had vanished. He pointed along the narrow corridor. We were free to enter. Two sharp turns and a dozen paces beyond the gate and its shaft of bright light, we came upon a kind of courtyard. Several men sat on rough wooden benches or stood in talking groups of two or three. Some were Arabs, dressed in loose cotton robes and kafirs. An Indian boy moved among them, serving black tea in long glasses. Some of the men looked at Prabhaka and me with frowning curiosity. When Prabhaka smiled widely and waved a greeting, they turned away, concentrating their attention once more on their conversation. Occasionally, one or another of them looked up to inspect a group of children who sat together on a long wooden bench beneath a ragged canvas awning. It was darker there after the bright light of the entrance chamber. A patchwork of canvas scraps provided an uneven cover that screened out most of the sky. Blank brown and magenta walls rose up all around us. The few windows I could see, through tears in the canvas coverings, were boarded over. Not a real courtyard. The roughly square space seemed unplanned, a kind of mistake, an almost forgotten architectural accident formed by building and rebuilding on the ruins of other structures within the congested block. The ground was paved with haphazard collections of tiles that had once been the floors of kitchens and bathrooms. Two naked bulbs, strange fruit on the withered vines of bare wires, provided the poor light. We moved to a quiet corner, accepted tea when it was offered, and sipped it in silence for a while. Then, speaking quietly and slowly, Prabhakar told me about the place he called the People Market. The children sitting beneath the tattered canopy were slaves. They'd come from the cyclone in West Bengal, the drought in Orissa, the cholera epidemic in Haryana, the secessionist fighting in Punjab. Sourced in calamity, recruited and purchased by scouts, the children had journeyed to Bombay by train, often alone, through all the many hundreds of kilometres. The men gathered in the courtyard were purchasers or agents. Although they seemed to express no great interest, talking amongst themselves and for the most part ignoring the children on the wooden bench, Prabhakar assured me that a restrained haggling was taking place and that bargains were being struck even as we watched. The children were thin, vulnerable, and small. Two of them sat with their four hands bunched together in a beehive ball. One child embraced another within the huddle of a protective arm. All of them stared out at the well-fed, well-clothed purchasers and agents, following every change of expression or emphatic gesture of their bejeweled hands. And the eyes of those children were like the black gleam at the bottom of a sweetwater well. What does it take to harden a man's heart? How could I see that place, look at those children, and not put a stop to it? Why didn't I contact the authorities? Why didn't I get a gun and put a stop to it myself? The answer to that, like the answers to all the big questions, came in many parts. I was a wanted man, a hunted criminal, living on the run. Contacting police or government authorities wasn't an option for me. I was a stranger in that strange land. It wasn't my country, and it wasn't my culture. I had to know more. I had to know the language that was spoken, at the very least, before I could presume to interfere. And I'd learned the hard way that sometimes, even with the purest intentions, we make things worse when we do our best to make things better. If I came back with a gun and stopped the slave market there, in that crooked concrete maze, it would start up again somewhere else. Stranger that I was, I knew that much. And maybe the new slave market in a different place would be worse. I was helpless to stop it, and I knew it. What I didn't know then, and what troubled me for a long time after that day of the slaves, was how I could be there and look at the children and not be crushed by it. I realized much later that a part of the answer lay in the Australian prison and the men I'd met there. Some of those men, too many of them, were serving their fourth or fifth prison sentences. Many of them had begun their imprisonment in reform schools, boys' homes they were called, and youth training centres, when they were no older than those Indian slave children. Some of them had been beaten, starved, and locked in solitary confinement. Some of them, too many of them, had been sexually abused. Ask any man with a long enough experience of prisons, and he'll tell you that all it takes to harden a man's heart is a system of justice. And strange and shameful as it is to admit it, I was glad that something, someone, some experience had flinted my heart. That hard stone within my chest was all that protected me from those first sounds and images of Prabhakar's dark tour of the city. Hands clapped in brittle echoes, and a little girl stood up from the bench to sing and dance. It was a love song from a popular Hindi movie. I heard it many times, hundreds of times, during the following years, and it always reminded me of that child, 10 years old, and her surprisingly strong, high, thin voice. She swayed her hips, pushing up her non-existent breasts in a child's imitation of a temptress burlesque, and new interest quirked the heads of the purchasers and agents. Prabhakar played the Virgil. His soft voice was ceaseless, explaining all that we saw and all that he knew. He told me that the children would have died if they hadn't found their way to the people market. Professional recruiters, known as talent scouts, roamed from one catastrophe to another, from drought to earthquake to flood. Starving parents, who'd already watched one or more of their children sicken and die, blessed the scouts, kneeling to touch their feet. They begged them to buy a son or a daughter, so that at least that one child would live. The boys on sale there were destined to work as camel jockeys in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other Gulf states. Some would be maimed in the camel races that provided afternoon entertainment for the rich sheikhs, Prabhakar said. Some would die. The survivors, grown too tall to ride in the races, were often abandoned to fend for themselves. The girls would work in households throughout the Middle East. Some of them would be used for sex. But they were alive, Prabhakar said, those boys and girls. They were the lucky ones. For every child who passed through the people market, there were 100 others or more who'd starved in unutterable agonies and were dead. The starving, the dead, the slaves. And through it all, the purr and rustle of Prabhakar's voice. There's a truth that's deeper than experience. It's beyond what we see or even what we feel. It's an order of truth that separates the profound from the merely clever and the reality from the perception. We're helpless usually in the face of it. And the cost of knowing it, like the cost of knowing love, is sometimes greater than any heart would willingly pay. It doesn't always help us to love the world, but it does prevent us from hating the world. And the only way to know that truth is to share it from heart to heart, just as Prabhakar told it to me, just as I'm telling it to you now.
Chapter 4. Do you know the Borsellino hat test?
The what?
The Borsellino hat test. It is the test that reveals whether a hat is a genuine Borsellino or an inferior imitator. You know about a Borsellino, no?
No, I can't say I do.
Ah.
Didier smiled. The smile was composed of one part surprise, one part mischief, and one part contempt. Somehow, those elements combined in an effect that was disarmingly charming. He leaned slightly forward and inclined his head to one side, his black curly hair shaking as if to emphasize the points in his explanation.
The Borsellino is a garment of the first and finest quality. It is believed by many, and myself included, to be the most outstanding gentleman's head covering ever made.
His hands shaped an imaginary hat on his head.
It is wide-brimmed, in black or white, and made from the furs of the lapin.
So, it's just a hat, I added, in what I thought to be an agreeable tone. We're talking about a rabbit fur hat. Didier was outraged.
Just a hat? Oh, no, my friend. The Borsellino is more than just a hat. The Borsellino is a work of art. It is brushed 10,000 times, by hand, before it is sold. It was the style expression of first choice by discerning French and Italian gangsters in Milan and Marseille for many decades. The very name of Borsellino became a synonym for gangsters. The wild young men of the underworld of Milano and Marseille were called Borsellinos. Those were the days when gangsters had some style. They understood that if you were to live as an outlaw and steal and shoot people for a living, you had a responsibility to dress with some elegance. Isn't it so?
It's the least they could do, I agreed, smiling.
But of course. Now, sadly, there is all attitude and no style. It is the mark of the age in which we live that the style becomes the attitude, instead of the attitude becoming the style.
He paused, permitting me a moment to acknowledge the turn of phrase.
And so, he continued, the test of a real Borsellino hat is to roll it into a cylinder, roll it up into a very tight tube, and pass it through a wedding ring. If it emerges from this test without permanent creases, and if it springs back to its original shape, and if it is not damaged in the experience, it is a genuine Borsellino.
And you're saying...
Just so,
Didier shouted, slamming a fist down on the table. We were sitting in Leopold's, near the square arch of the causeway doors, at 8 o'clock. Some foreigners at the next table turned their heads at the noisy outburst, but the staff and the regulars ignored the Frenchman. Didier had been eating and drinking and expostulating at Leopold's for 9 years. They all knew there was a line you could cross with him, a limit to his tolerance, and he was a dangerous man if you crossed it. They also knew that the line wasn't drawn in the soft sand of his own life or beliefs or feelings. Didier's line was drawn through the hearts of the people he loved. If you hurt them in any way, you roused him to a cold and deadly rage. But nothing anyone said or did to him, short of actual bodily harm, ever really offended or angered him.
Comme ça, that is my point. Your little friend, Brabaker, has put you through the hat test. He rolled you into a tube and dragged you through the wedding ring to see if you are a real Borsalino or not. That was his purpose in taking you on the tour of the bad sights and sounds of the city. It was a Borsalino test.
I sipped my coffee in silence, knowing that he was right. Prabhakar's dark tour had been a kind of test, but not willing to give Didier the trophy of conceding the point. The evening crowd of tourists from Germany, Switzerland, France, England, Norway, America, Japan, and a dozen other countries thinned out, giving way to the night crowd of Indians and expatriates who called Bombay home. The locals reclaimed places like Leopold's, the Macambo, Café Mondega, and the Light of Asia every night when the tourists sought the safety of their hotels. If it was a test, I did at last concede. He must have given me a pass. He invited me to go with him to visit his family, in his village in the north of the state. Didier raised his eyebrows in theatrical surprise.
For how long?
I don't know. A couple of months, I think. Maybe more.
Ah, then it is so,
he concluded.
Your little friend is beginning to love you.
I think that's putting it a bit strong, I objected, frowning.
No, no, you do not understand. You must be careful here with the real affection of those you meet. This is not like any other place. This is India. Everyone who comes here falls in love. Most of us fall in love many times over. And the Indians, they love most of all. Your little friend may be beginning to love you. There is nothing strange in this. I say it from a long experience of this country, and especially of this city. It happens often and easily for the Indians. That is how they manage to live together, a billion of them, in reasonable peace. They are not perfect, of course. They know how to fight and lie and cheat each other, and all the things that all of us do. But more than any other people in the world, the Indians know how to love one another.
He paused to light a cigarette, and then waved it like a little flagpole until the waiter noticed him and nodded to his request for another glass of vodka.
India is about 6 times the size of France, he went on, as the glass of alcohol and a bowl of curried snacks arrived at our table. But it has almost 20 times the population. 20 times! Believe me, if there were 1 billion Frenchmen living in such a crowded space, there would be rivers of blood. Rivers of blood! And as everyone knows, we French are the most civilized people in Europe. Indeed, in the whole world. No, no. Without love, India would be impossible.
Letitia joined us at our table, sitting to my left.
What do you want about now, Didier, you bastard?
She asked companionably, her South London accent giving the first syllable of the last word an explosive ring. He was just telling me that the French are the most civilized people in the world.
As all the world knows, he added.
When you produce a Shakespeare out of your veal and vineyards, mate, I might just agree with you,
Letty murmured through a smile that seemed to be warm and condescending in equal parts.
My dear, please do not think that I disrespect your Shakespeare,
Didier countered, laughing happily.
I love the English language, because so much of it is French.
Touché, I grinned, as we say in English.
Ulla and Modena arrived at that moment and sat down. Ulla was dressed for work in a small, tight, black halter neck dress, fishnet stockings and stiletto heel shoes. She wore eye-dazzling fake diamonds at her throat and ears. The contrast between her clothing and Letty's was stark. Letty wore a fine, bone-coloured brocade jacket over loose, dark brown satin culottes and boots. Yet the faces of the two women produced the strongest and most unexpected contrast. Letty's gaze was seductive, direct, self-assured, and sparkling with ironies and secrets, while Ulla's wide blue eyes, for all the makeup and clothing of her professional sexuality, showed nothing but innocence, honest, vacuous innocence.
"You are forbidden to speak to me, Didier," Ulla said at once, pouting inconsolably. "I have had a very disagreeable time with Federico. 3 hours, and it is all your fault."
"Bah," Didier spat out. "Federico!"
"Oh,"
Letty joined in, making 3 long sounds out of one.
"Something's happened to the beautiful young Federico, has it? Come on, Ulla, me darling, let's have all the gossip." "Naya, Federico has got a religion, and he is driving me crazy about it, and it is all Didier's fault."
"Yes," Didier added, clearly disgusted. "Federico has found religion. It is a tragedy. He no longer drinks or smokes or takes drugs. And of course, he will not have sex with anyone, not even with himself. It is an appalling waste of talent. The man was a genius of the corruptions, my finest student, my masterwork. It is maddening. He is now a good man in the very worst sense of the word."
"Well, you win a few, you lose a few,"
Letty sighed with mock sympathy.
"You mustn't let it get you down, Didier. There'll be other fish for you to fry and gobble up."
"Your sympathy should be for me," Ulla chided. "Federico came from Didier in such a bad mood yesterday. He was at my door today in tears. Scheiße, wirklich. For 3 hours he cried and he raved at me about being born again. In the end I felt so sorry for him. It was only with a great suffering that I let Modena throw him and his Bible books onto the street. It's all your fault, Didier, and I will take the longest time to forgive you for it."
"Fanatics," Didier mused, ignoring the rebuke. "Always seem to have the same scrubbed and staring look about them. They have the look of people who do not masturbate, but who think about it almost all the time."
"I really do love you, you know, Didier,"
Letty stuttered through her bubbling laughter.
"Even if you are a despicable toad of a man." "No, you love him because he is a despicable toe of a man," Ulla declared. "That's toad love, not toe,"
Letty corrected patiently, still laughing.
"He's a toad of a man, not a toe of a man. A despicable toe wouldn't make any sense at all, now would it? We wouldn't love him or hate him just for being a toe of a man, would we, darling? Even if we knew what it meant."
"I'm not so good with the English jokes, you know that, Letty," Ulla persisted. "But I think he is a big, ugly, hairy toe of a man."
"I assure you," Didier protested, "that my toes, and my feet for that matter, are exceptionally beautiful."
Carla, Maurizio, and an Indian man in his early 30s walked in from the busy night street. Maurizio and Modena joined a second table to ours, and then the 8 of us ordered drinks and food.
"Lynn, Letty, this is my friend, Vikram Patel," Carla announced, when there was a moment of relative quiet. "He came back a couple of weeks ago, after a long holiday in Denmark, and I think you're the only two who haven't met him."
Letty and I introduced ourselves to the newcomer, but my real attention was on Maurizio and Carla. He sat beside her, opposite me, and rested his hand on the back of her chair. He leaned in close to her, and their heads almost touched when they spoke. There's a dark feeling, less than hatred but more than loathing, that ugly men feel for handsome men. It's unreasonable and unjustified, of course, but it's always there, hiding in the long shadow thrown by envy. It creeps out into the light of your eyes when you're falling in love with a beautiful woman. I looked at Maurizio, and a little of that dark feeling began in my heart. His straight white teeth, smooth complexion, and thick dark hair turned me against him more swiftly and surely than flaws in his character might have done. and Carla was beautiful. Her hair, in a French roll, was shining like water running over black river stones, and her green eyes were radiant with purpose and pleasure. She wore a long-sleeved Indian salwar top that reached to below her knees, where it met loose trousers in the same olive silk fabric.
"I had a great time, yeah,"
the newcomer, Vikram, was saying when my thoughts returned to the moment.
"Denmark is very hip, very cool. Their people are very sophisticated. They're so fucking controlled, I couldn't believe it. I went to a sauna in Copenhagen. It was a fucking huge place, yeah, with a mixed setup, with men and women together, walking around stark naked, absolutely totally naked. And nobody reacted at all, not even a flickering eye, yeah? Indian guys couldn't handle that. They'd be boiling, I tell you."
"Were you boiling, Vikram dear?"
Letty asked sweetly.
"Are you fucking kidding? I was the only guy in the place wearing a towel, the only guy with a hat on."
"I don't understand," Ulla said when we stopped laughing. It was a flat statement, neither a complaint nor a plea for further explanation.
"Hey, I went there every day for 3 weeks, yar," Vikram continued. "I thought that if I just spent enough time there, I'd get used to it, like all the super cool Danes."
"Get used to what?" Ulla asked. Vikram frowned at her, bewildered, then turned to Letty.
"It was no good. It was useless. After 3 weeks, I still had to wear the towel. No matter how often I went there, when I saw those bouncy bits going up and down and side to side, I stiffened up. What can I say? I'm too Indian for a place like that."
"It is the same for Indian women," Maurizio observed. "Even when they are making love, it is not possible to be naked."
"Well, that's not always true," Vikram went on. "And anyway, it's the guys who are the problem here. Indian women are ready to change. Young Indian chicks from middle-class families are wild about change, yar. They're educated and they're ready for short hair, short dresses and short love affairs. They're ready for it, but the guys are holding them back. The average Indian guy has a sexual maturity of about 14.
"Tell me about it," Letty muttered.
Kavita Singh had approached our table moments before and stood behind Vikram while he made his observations about Indian women. With short, styled hair and wearing jeans and a white sweatshirt bearing the emblem of New York University, she was the living woman, the physical representation of what Vikram had been saying. She was the real thing.
"You're such a chud, Vicky," she said, taking a place opposite him and on my right side. "You say all this, but you're just as bad as all the rest. Look at how you treat your own sister, yar, if she dares to wear jeans and a tight sweater."
"Hey, I bought her that tight sweater in London last year," Vikram protested.
"But you still gave her buckets of grief when she wore it to the Jazz Yatra, nah?
Well, how was I to know that she would want to wear it outside the apartment?"
he countered lamely, provoking laughter and derision from the whole group. None laughed harder than Vikram himself. Vikram Patel was of average height and build, but average stopped just there with those characteristics. His thick, curly black hair framed a handsome, intelligent face. The bright and animated light brown eyes stared out confidently above a long, hawk-like nose and a sharp, immaculately trimmed Zapata moustache. His clothes were black, cowboy boots, jeans, shirt, and leather vest, and he wore a flat black Spanish flamenco hat on his back, hanging from a leather thong at his throat. His bolo tie, dollar coin belt, and hatband were all in silver. He looked like a hero in a spaghetti western movie, and that was in fact the inspiration for his style. Vikram had an obsession with Sergio Leone's films, Once Upon a Time in the West and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Later, when I knew him better, when I watched him win the heart of the woman he loved, and when we stood together to face and fight enemies who wanted to kill me, I learned that he was a hero, and that he would have held his own with any of the gunslingers he adored. Sitting opposite him on that first meeting, I was struck by the ease with which he assumed his black cowboy dream and the stylish assurance that carried it off. "Vikram is the kind of man who wears his sleeve on his heart," Carla once said. It was an affectionate joke, and one that we all understood, but there was a brittle filament of scorn in it as well. I didn't laugh with the others when she said it. People like Vikram, People who can wear an obsession with panache always win me over because their honesty speaks directly to my heart.
No, it's true, he persisted.